Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Humphrey Bogart played tough guys in the movies. For years, he was the gangster in B-films, the one who was killed in a blaze of gunfire. Later, he became a genuine movie star and American cultural hero. But the man behind the legend didn't begin life as a tough guy from the wrong side of the tracks. Today, we're going to talk about Humphrey Bogart with Stefan Kampfer, the author of Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. Stefan Kampfer's books include Ball of Fire, The Tumultuous Life and Comic Art of Lucille Ball, Stardust Lost, The Triumph, Tragedy, and Meshuggahs of the Yiddish Theater in America, and Somebody, The Reckless Life and Remarkable Career of Marlon Brando. He was a writer and editor at Time Magazine for more than 20 years and was its first bylined film critic from 1967 to 1972. Welcome to the show, Stefan.
It's my pleasure to be here.
I read an interview with Humphrey Bogart's last wife, Lauren Bacall, of course, who said that the great thing about our marriage is whenever he wanted to teach me, he said, long after I'm gone, you'll remember me, and he's become this incredible icon. That's what she said. That idea is echoed in the title of your book and really the theme of your book.
Well, the title is not mine, really. It comes from Raymond Chandler, who was, you know, the inventor of Philip Marlowe and a great hard-boiled mystery writer. And a number of actors were offered to him for various parts. And he said, frankly, Alan Ladd, for example, is a little boy's idea of what a tough guy is. But he said that Bogart really is tough, and he's tough without a gun. He was delighted when Bogart played one of his detectives.
I should have said the subtitle. The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart in that. That's partly what this is all about, He still is the greatest.
It's really odd because when you think he's been gone for more than 50 years, and most of the contemporary actors at his time, of course, are remembered fondly like Gary Cooper or Cary Grant, but they don't have this kind of cumulative power that Bogart has. That is to say, he seems stronger in our memory than he did when he was alive.
And not only that, but contemporary actors today, does anyone hold a candle to any of those three fellows that you mentioned?
You know, it's interesting that you say that because I was thinking the other day there used to be impressionists like Rich Little and many others who would do movie stars in the past. In fact, when I was a kid, we all did them. We all mimicked, Jimmy Cagney, You Dirty Rat, or something like that, or Cary Grant. Nobody does a Brad Pitt today. You know, nobody tries to do Leonardo DiCaprio. That's just not a style that's embedded in our consciousness anymore. And no, there is no Bogart around, or even a Bogart imitator around now, I don't think.
Doesn't that partly have to do with the material that the genre of movie back then in Bogart's time, you know, had a lot of gangsters, and that was just something that was very popular and so somewhat redundant?
Well, he also had the power to crystallize whatever the nation felt at the moment. For example, in Casablanca, his probably most famous or most beloved film, he plays a man who's sort of isolationist, as the United States was, and is kind of convinced to pledge himself to the war and be noble and relinquish the great love of his life to go off and fight in World War II, which was indeed what the United States did and what we Americans did. So I think he always had that ability to reflect something that the American male needed at that moment.
My guest is Stefan Kampfer. He's author of Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. If you have a question or comment for our guest, Stefan Kampfer, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You have a special memory about Humphrey Bogart? Do you remember that first movie? No matter what your age, give us a call or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. In the 1936 film Petrified Forest, Humphrey Bogart plays the notorious gangster Duke Manti, who invades a roadside diner, taking a group of innocent people hostage. In this scene, Manti shoots one of the hostages as a warning to the others.
It was a bad shot, Pop, but I had to get it off fast. Now, I let that mug make a mug out of me, but don't anybody try it again. Just keep in mind that I and the boys is candidates for hanging. And the first time any one of you makes a wrong move, I'm going to kill a whole lot of you.
Yeesh. Humphrey Bogart was 37 when he made The Petrified Forest, but the part of Duke Manti was his big chance at a leading film role. It was first offered to, speaking of someone you mentioned earlier, Edward G. Robinson. How did Bogart get the part?
Well, it's very interesting because Bogart had a stage career And it wasn't a very accomplished stage career, but he worked a lot. He had a real apprenticeship on the stage. And he was in this as a kind of change of venue for him. He was cast against the part. He used to play Pretty Boys. It's very odd to think of him that way, but my book will show that in some of the pictures. And they just decided, one of the producers said, there's something about this guy that's very compelling. Let's put him on the stage as a crook, a wild-eyed, you know, heart-of-the-country kind of maniac, and see how it works. And he became a sensation overnight. And because he was so compelling and so masculine, it was thought that he could go and do that part in Hollywood. And in fact, Edward G. Robinson was too big to ignore, and Warner Brothers was all set to star him as Duke Mantee, but Edward G. Robinson wanted a lot of money, and Jack Warner did not like to be pushed around by anybody, particularly actors. Writers, he called schmucks with Underwoods, but actors he had very little use for. And when he thought that Edward G. Robinson was too big for his pants, he said, okay, I'll take this unknown from New York, and we'll give him a shot. And that was the beginning.
How much of the alchemy of Humphrey Bogart at that point in his career as an act had to do with his age? Because he was 37, which was, even then, it was very old to be reaching that height then.
Well, it's interesting you should say that. He was, by the terms today, he would be ancient. But in fact, at that point, you know, the economic power resided largely with daddy and not with the kids. And when the family went out, let's say a family of four, it was the father who paid. And the father wanted to see somebody more or less his own age, mature, somebody who reflected his looks and his feelings. Whereas today, you know, the economic power is in the hands of teenagers, and naturally they want to see somebody, you know, they want to see at the most an old man like Johnny Depp. They don't want to see anybody really old. But that was not the case with Bogart, and even later in the Maltese Falcon when he was 42 and really made it big. It was old by our standards now. It was not so much then.
So he was marketable. He was what was marketable back then.
Well, very much so, and there was something compelling about black and white. I don't think he would have made it, actually, as big if he had started in color. But Warner Brothers really knew how to light black and white. And there was something, John Huston said this to me once. He said that if you met Bogart on the street, you would think he was a nice-looking man, about 5'8", nothing compelling about him. But somehow, when he was in front of the cameras, some magic happened with the eyes, with that grim mouth, with that strange speech defect that he had, and it worked in his favor.
Yeah, the much very interesting face, that doesn't seem to be the case. You have very good-looking actors these days. I mean, Matt Damon, in fact, he's the sort of one you're kind of interested to see what he's going to look like in another 10 years.
I don't think he's going to look that different in another 10 years. I think Bogart really was the face of his time.
So where did that face come from?
Well,
he very unlikely background.
It's a very good question, because he came from a WASP family. His father was a surgeon who had gone to Yale Medical School, very competent man, and later got hooked on drugs, but of a medical kind. His mother was the most famous illustrator of her time, Maud Humphrey. You can still find some of her pieces available now.
Was it the Gerber baby?
She did the Gerber baby. Mm-hmm. He was not the Gerber baby, but she did the Gerber baby. And the two of them made so much money that they had a townhouse New York City, and Humphrey grew up under very comfortable circumstances with two sisters. But he was a rebel all his life, and he got kicked out of various schools, including Phillips Andover, where his father had gone, and wound up in the Navy. And he misbehaved in the Navy and served in the brig a few times. Mm-hmm. And one time he was, as far as everybody knows, this is the true story, he was escorting a prisoner, and the prisoner smacked him with his handcuffs and split his lip. It never healed correctly, and that was the reason for that kind of stiff upper lip delivery. He had that kind of tough-sounding, tight-lipped delivery. And because of that, it made him sort of unique. People had never heard someone like that. They've heard round, orotund sounds coming, particularly when movies started early on and sound was a big deal. He was different, and I think that helped him, even though it made him strange, but it helped him in the end.
You know, his rebelliousness, I was wondering as I was reading the book and about his life, it wasn't as easy as it seemed on the surface. It was not an easy life. There was a lot of dysfunction in the family, and a lot of times kids are rebellious because they're trying to get attention.
Well, you're absolutely right. I think good attention, bad attention, it was just attention. He needed that. His parents did not get along. They never divorced. but they didn't really get along very well. And after a while, I think he just wanted out. Both of his sisters met rather tragic ends, and he himself, as we know, was married four times. Finally, happily, he married four actresses, and one of them was an alcoholic and really quite an abusive, verbally and physically abusive woman who actually stabbed him in the back once, Mayo Mirtho. And it was just about that time when he was about to give it all up that he met this wonderful 19-year-old, and he was in his 40s. He wouldn't have thought it would work, but it did.
His mother was very remote.
His mother was a very cold lady, never embraced them, and they didn't call her mom. It was not something that he could ever get used to, and I think that was one of the roots of his troubles with women.
After making a splash in Petrified Forest, he was stuck on gangster films for a while.
Well, he was stuck on gangster films before and after. He was the one who kept getting killed. You know, he was not a star. And he said, I spent more time writhing around on the floor than I did standing up, because they knocked him off in the second reel until finally he got his big break. But it didn't occur with the Petrified Forest. He had to pay his dues even after that.
Yeah, that was the 1941 movie, The Maltese Falcon. Humphrey Bogart plays crack private investigator Sam Spade, who eventually discovers his beautiful client and lover, played by Mary Astor, is in fact a murderess who has killed his partner. In this memorable scene, Spade confronts her with the truth.
You're not.
Yes, Angel, I'm going to send you over. The chances are you'll get off with life. That means if you're a good girl, you'll be out in 20 years. I'll be waiting for you. If they hang you, I'll always remember you.
He was not the first choice to play that role of Sam Spade, but he was eager to play the part, and first-time director John Huston wanted him for the lead, but that wasn't even enough. How did he get that job?
George Raft was, at that point, a very hot star, believe it or not, at Warner Brothers, and he said, this is not a serious movie. This is not a serious George Raft big-time movie, and besides, who is this director? It's a first-time director. He's 35 years old. John Huston, never heard of him. He's son of an actor, no thank you. So he walked off, and Huston, of course, was duly grateful because he loved Bogart, and they were men's men. They liked to drink, they liked to talk, they got on famously, and everybody in that show got on famously. And you had Sidney Greenstreet, Peter Lorre. It was just a wonderful conjunction of confluence of talents. And George Raft was sort of never heard of again. He did one more picture for Warner Brothers, and then went into obscurity. And he said to himself once, and then loudly, there but for the grace of God go I, when he looked at Bogart. He could have had the role, but didn't.
I'm talking with Stefan Kampfer. He is a film critic and author of a new book about Humphrey Bogart. It's called Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News. Be sure to watch Columbus on the Record, Friday night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV. This week, News and Public Affairs Director Mike Thompson and his panel discuss a possible Ted Strickland-John Kasich rematch. The Republican race for the U.S. Senate takes shape, and the Senate budget bill. That and more on Columbus on the Record tomorrow night at 8:30 on WOSU-TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from WOW Internet Cable and Phone, where personal service comes standard with every installation. Details on bundle packages and services are available online at wowway.com or by phone at 8664-WOW-NOW.
83 degrees in downtown Columbus, a chance of showers and thunderstorms building throughout the afternoon, otherwise some sunshine, a high near 90. A chance of showers and thunderstorms tonight, a low of 66 degrees, also a chance of rain for Friday. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm talking with Stefan Kampfer. He is author of a new book about Humphrey Bogart. It's called Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. If you have a question or comment for Stefan, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. It was interesting to learn about what he did during his salad days and how he used chess to raise extra money.
Yeah, I don't think that was not his salad days. I think that was before he had salad.
Yeah.
He and his wife were pretty poor.
Well, yeah, right. Pre-salad days, I mean, yeah.
And he was a very good chess player and remained a very good chess player, one of the best in Hollywood. And that's saying a lot because there's some good players out there. And he supported them. It used to be 50 cents a game. You played. If you won, you'd take 50 cents. And he won enough games so he could buy dinner, which in those days was a couple of bucks. And that's how they got through the tough seasons when they were both acting on stage. And you could go for months, even when there was a lot of productions on Broadway, you could go for months without working.
He was something of a bad boy. He liked to party, but he was extremely professional on the job.
He was, in general. Only once did he show up hungover, and his co-star gave him such hell, he never did it again. He worked for a guy named Brady, who was a producer, and Brady had a delineation of people in show business. He said there are only two kinds, professionals and bums, and Bogart came to believe that, and no matter how hungover he was, no matter how drunk he was, he knew his lines. He never bumped into the furniture. He was always a real pro about that and not a bum, and he was proud of that.
Yeah, there was one incident involving the stuffed panda bears at the El Morocco about mid-career. It gave one of his detractors at that time, Jack Warner, an excuse to try to derail his career.
Yes, he was in a nightclub. He shouldn't have been there. New York was no longer his scene, and he was drunk and with a friend, and some lady evidently wanted the panda that he had bought, some stuffed panda, and they began grappling over it, and she fell down. And of course, it was in the papers the next day. Nothing ever happened, but it was not good publicity for him. And Jack Warner, who liked to practice judo on all his actors, tried to derail, and I don't think derail, but certainly get him to work cheap.
Okay.
And Bogart wasn't going to do that, and so he would get suspended every now and then. Like Betty Davis would. These were the fighters who watched their career, and in general, they did pretty well. They won their battles, and Warner got his licks in a few times. But in general, they did very well. The pictures did well, and they became superstars.
The 1942 film Casablanca gave Humphrey Bogart his first chance at a leading romantic role and created the archetypal Bogart hero.
True.
Tough but tender, cynical with a grudging idealism. There are so many memorable lines in Casablanca. Here's one of the most famous scenes as Bogart explains to Ingrid Bergman why she has to leave him and follow her husband.
I've got a job to do, too. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of. Ilse, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. No. He's looking at you, kid.
This scene captured the sacrifices that ordinary people were making during World War II, so it perfectly reflected its era, yet it became universal also. I mean, just as I'm listening to that, I can literally visualize, and I'm sure, of course, you can too as an expert in it. But how did the character of Rick, played by Humphrey Bogart, capture the imagination of audiences back then? And why is it so sustained?
It's mostly Bogart, because that film, as you probably know, was made up as it went along. I mean, first of all, Ingrid Bergman was not attracted to either of her co-stars. She was bored by Paul Henri, and she said about Bogart, who was very remote and having marital problems at that point, she said, "I kissed him, but I never knew him." Furthermore, they didn't really know how the film was going to end, and she had to look at both Paul Henri and at Humphrey Bogart with something like love, but something less than love. And it was only, I think, the fact that the film had very good writers, but it also had wonderful actors. Everybody in that film has an accent, a real European accent, except for Bogart and Dooley Wilson, who, of course, is the black piano player. And I think what Bogart did there was, you could see he was in love with Ingrid Bergman, but he was going to have to give her up. That was a great act of renunciation. It wasn't like Mary Astor, who, after all, was a bad girl in the Maltese. This is a wonderful woman, beautiful. Of course, Ingrid Bergman, then at her most beautiful. But he was going to have to give her, and somehow that just got to everybody, not only in the 40s, but then again in the 60s when college kids began to see that. And of course, every college kid sees himself as a kind of self-sacrificial, dramatic figure. And it just has never died, that whole notion of the male who must give up something because he is in a noble cause. has just it remains with us as strongly now as the day it was filmed.
If you want to talk to our guest, Stefan Kampfer, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Stefan is the author of a new book. It's called Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. And Rick from Pittsburgh, you're driving through. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, hey, great show. Very interesting personality, obviously. I just had a question. I know you said that he was involved, you know, in the stage first and then, you know, obviously got into filmmaking. I was just wondering, you know, obviously with stage acting, you get, you know, reinforcement from the audience and it's very interactive. And obviously when you're making a film, it, things are done over and over and over again. Did he ever complain about that or did he like that? Obviously he was did very well in films and stuff, but I've heard, you know, actors and actresses say, man, I spend most of the time, you know, not doing anything on set, waiting and this and that. I'm just wondering if he ever complained about that.
That's a very good question, you know, because it's two kinds of art. There's the art of stage acting, which is much larger. The gestures are larger. And, of course, the reward is immediate applause. And there's no such thing in film, and you do have to do it over and over and over again. I think what Bogart felt was, this is a profession, and whatever it demands, I'm going to do it. I'll have to learn a different kind of acting, which he did. I remember years ago, Walter Matthau told me that when he was on stage, he acted a certain way, and he said he couldn't quite get it. He couldn't quite get the little gestures, and he was watching Audrey Hepburn one day, and he said she did nothing. She did absolutely nothing, and he said this lady's going to vanish. And then he saw the dailies and realized that she did terrific acting, but it was all very small. And I think Bogart had to learn to do the small stuff with the eyes, with that dangerous look he had, the grim mouth and the delivery. And I think he actually came to like films, although it was an adjustment to make. You're absolutely right.
Thanks to Rick for that call. We have an email from Marty. He asks, did he get along with Betty Davis on the set of Dark Victory? That's right. He was her manager.
Well, he said, quote, she scared the bejesus out of me. I think he never really understood her kind of acting. She was a very powerful actress. And I think he liked to, you know, be in control. When they were dancing, he liked to lead. Nobody's going to lead. When you dance with Betty Davis, she led. So I don't think that's that was the kind of lady he felt comfortable with.
And, you know, it came across in the film a little bit. It probably was a good thing.
Well, I think the tension is always interesting to watch, yes. But I don't think there was anything like romance. There was nothing remotely like that with him and Betty Davis. Or with most of his co-stars, actually.
Well, let's talk about his fourth wife, Lauren Bacall, and how they met. How did that work? And was it so many? It seemed like with his wives, it was, except for the first one, which he wasn't very interested in, you know, he loved them. I mean, it was very quick that he became involved with them and got married.
He did. He felt originally with Lauren Bacall that it really wasn't going to work because there were so many years between them, and he was another generation, and she was very innocent. She really was. And she was not all that good an actress either. She had to learn as she went along. But there was such sexual tension between the two of them, and it worked so well that, you know, they just became one of the celebrated Hollywood couples. But he was going through a very bad time at the end of his third marriage, and he really said, look, I've got to give this another shot. I cannot walk away from this woman until I'm satisfied that it's really not going to work. And he did give it one more shot, and Mayometho fell off the wagon again, and it was just impossible. And they finally came to terms, and he married Lauren Bacall and, you know, then became a father of a boy and a girl, and I think had as happy a marriage as you can have in Hollywood.
The second film that Humphrey Bogart made with Lauren Bacall is the 1946 film The Big Sleep. Bogart is Private Eye Philip Marlowe, and Bacall is the beautiful daughter of his wealthy client. In this famous scene, Bacall flirts with Marlowe and compares their relationship to playing the horses.
I'd say you don't like to be rated. You like to get out in front, open up a lead, take a little breather in the back stretch, and come home free.
You don't like to be rated yourself.
I haven't met anyone yet that could do it. Any suggestions?
Well, I can't tell till I've seen you over a distance of ground. You've got a touch of class, but I don't know how far you can go.
A lot depends on who's in the saddle.
I'm amazed that they were able to get that thing through when they did. That would be
exactly.
I think it was only because they did it so artfully and in a way so innocently. You know, he's just sort of trying to understand her, allegedly, and she understand him, that they got away with it. It really is pretty sexy stuff.
It was very sexy. It was a new type of romantic relationship for the film.
It was tough, and she could be tough, too. I mean, she had that nice, surly feeling about her. You know, it was almost a masculine. She's so feminine that it didn't matter, but she had a masculine approach. She wasn't going to be pushed around. Of course, that worked very well for the two of them.
What about their relationship? That was what it looked like on screen, but their relationship, it was pretty much the same?
I think so. I think they had, you know, they had a few rocky moments because he did have a girlfriend on the side, or so it was said, his hairdresser, or really more like wig maker because he was pretty bald. And she wrote a book about it, and I'm sure there was something to it. But as I said, this is a Hollywood marriage, and as Hollywood marriages go, it was quite satisfactory. And I really did think that they loved each other, and he was very proud of the fact that he had become a father in late middle age.
Was he, but he suffered for that. I mean, he had to, there were fertility treatments and
hormone treatments.
Hormone treatments, that's right. And that's part of the reason why he lost his hair.
It didn't help. I think he was going to lose his hair anyway, but it certainly didn't help. He wanted those kids so badly that I think he was willing to do anything to make sure that happened. And they were both successful pregnancies. His son wrote a book about it, Stephen Bogart, about his childhood. He was only 8 when his father died, and I think was haunted the rest of his life by that image. I mean, how can you live up to that?
Well, 614-292-8513. That's the number to call if you want to chat with Stephen Kamfer. He's the author of a new book, Tough Without a Gun: The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. What kind of father was he with Stephen and Leslie, his daughter?
I think it was all a mystery to Humphrey Bogart. He really was not the child of very strong, loving parents, and I think he didn't know quite how to handle these kids. There's a wonderful anecdote before he became a father. One of his friends had a kid, and he said, you know, talk to the kid, give him a little moral background. So he took the kid out, and he said, listen, kid, there are 13 commandments. I mean, he had no idea how to talk to kids. He had no idea how to play with kids, but they were awfully young. You know, he got sick and died while the kids were, you know, 5 and 7 years old. It was very difficult for them to quite understand. I think he was a loving father and gave them all the objects that a child should have, but they never really had a chance to bond.
You know, in that same interview that I mentioned earlier with Bacall, she was reminiscing about Bogart, saying that he was a man of honor and integrity who, quote, lived his life by the Ten Commandments and the Golden Rule. And she said, and by golly, if anyone lied to him, they were out. It's impossible to know, because she didn't elaborate in that interview, but she could have been talking about the friends he defended to the House Un-American Activities Committee and when he thought that they truly weren't involved with the communists.
Well, what happened was, at the beginning, you know, the Hollywood, first of all, it was the Hollywood 19, called the Unfriendly 19, and Billy Wilder said some of them had talent, the rest were just unfriendly. And then it became the Hollywood 10, and these writers and directors were thought to be communists, and they denied it, and in fact they were. They lied to their own lawyers. And for a while, Bogart went along with them, and I think correctly so, feeling that, you know, these guys should be given their own shot and shouldn't be blacklisted out of the business. But then he found he was being manipulated by them, and he said, I'm not going to give up my career for these guys who are themselves careerists. A lot of people disliked him for that, but I think he probably made the correct decision. It was very murky, and some of these communists were heroes, and some of them were just Stalinists of no particular value. Some had talent, some didn't. I think the people who describe him as a coward are incorrect. I think he just had had it with being manipulated by people who never told the truth. And, you know, he was lied to, and as Lauren Bacall points out, if you get lied to, particularly the way he was, and with his professionals and bums feeling, I think he felt they were bums. He was a professional. He was not going to have anything more to do with them.
Wes in Reynoldsburg, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Yes, I wonder if you could discuss a little further his political support for Roosevelt.
Well, Roosevelt was the, I think, the standard bearer for everybody in Hollywood. You know, the Hollywood liberal in those days was just a Democrat who believed in Roosevelt. And it wasn't until Adlai Stevenson ran that Bogart sort of separated. He was for Eisenhower briefly, and then his wife said, no, we've got to. She had a great crush on Adlai Stevenson, and a real crush, and convinced Humphrey to go along with it, which he really didn't want to do. But he was a liberal in a way that liberals were in the 40s. This is just somebody who believed in, you know, the New Deal, in shorter working hours, in a fair deal for unions. There was no sense of radicalism or what we would think of today as liberalism as a different form today from what it did in those days. He was just an FDR Democrat.
But the tradition of movie of Hollywood getting involved in politics, was it established around that time, or did it predate their generation?
I think that was the time. First of all, media then became big. I mean, right. I'm sure there were, you know, the times in the silent movies when there were some. But no, it was when Roosevelt, after all, commanded the microphone, and when movie stars could appear on radio shows rallying for the Democrats, which is indeed what happened. But they were all in it together. There was no sense of, you know, trying to shout down the opposition or anything. They just came out and said, vote for FDR, he's our guy. That was pretty much it. It's so different from what we think of today in the dueling franchises of various politicians. It was much more gentlemanly and ladylike then.
My guest is Stephan Kamfer. He's author of Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. If you have a question or comment for him, we welcome them. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
British comedian Steve Coogan is a man of many voices.
I'd like a vodka martini, shaken but not stirred.
He and comic Rob Brydon trade barbs and impersonations in the new road film, The Trip. On the next Fresh Air, Steve Coogan and Las Vegas pawn shop owner Rick Harrison of the History Channel's Pawn Stars. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes, starting at noon on 89.7 NPR News. Based on her new book, Susie Orman's Money Class will reveal Susie's advice on what actions people need to take in light of the new economy. Friday night on WOSU TV, learn about what Susie calls the new American dream, which rethinks many of the traditional strategies we've been using to achieve our financial goals. Hear what actions people need to take in light of the economic downturn. Watch Susie Orman Money Class. It's tomorrow night at 9 on WOSU TV.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Sherrington Group, financial planners and investment consultants helping clients achieve financial independence through professional planning at sherringtongroup.com.
83 degrees at 11:40 this morning. Partly sunny skies today with a chance of showers and thunderstorms building this afternoon, a high near 90. Also a chance of showers and pop-up thunderstorms tonight, a low of 66. That chance of rain sticks around for Friday, a high of 85. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
My guest is Stephan Kamfer. He's author of the book Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. Give us a call, 614-292-8513 if you'd like to speak with him. And Lance from Columbus, you're on the air with Stephan Kamfer. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you. I live in Columbus. I'm fairly new here. There's a state park near Columbus. I think it has the home of Steinbeck. And
Malabar Farms, I think you're talking about?
I don't remember where it could be, but at the home, the author invited Humphrey Bogart and Bacall for their honeymoon, and they honeymooned in this home of the famous author. And so I was wondering if the writer of the book could discuss the relationship.
Be delighted. It was Lewis Bromfield as the writer.
Oh, yes.
He was a novelist and a screenwriter, and he struck up a great friendship with Bogart. Interestingly enough, Bromfield was a really staunch Republican, and as we know, Bogart was a Democrat. But they just got on famously. They were very fond of each other. And when it came time to get married, they went to Melville Farms and got married there. It was a very touching ceremony. There weren't a lot of people around. They didn't want 1,000 paparazzi. You can't help it. There were some, but they didn't want the usual Hollywood mob there, so they chose to go to Ohio, and there they had a very nice honeymoon, and it was probably the most unexpected place for them to go. Nobody would think that two movie stars would wind up in Ohio, but that was the case.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lance. Speaking of the fame and the paparazzi and all of that, how did he handle that attention? He was something of a loner. He liked to sail in his sailboats.
That's exactly what he did. I mean, that's a very astute of you. He really couldn't stand it. He didn't like the whole idea of publicity. It was not his thing. Actually, Luella Parsons and the mob around her sort of liked him. Hedda Hopper liked him, but he didn't really care much for them. He wasn't as in-your-face as Marlon Brando was, but he didn't want to have much to do with them, and so he got on his boat. And he went out, and his idea of an out-of-town trip was to go 3 or 4 miles out past Catalina Island, because there you were serene. He was always a sailor, even when he was a kid. His father was a sailor, so he knew how to do that. And he just loved being away from the mainland, away from the publicity, just by himself. And actually, Lauren Bacall was not much of a sailor, so he was by himself or with a couple of his hands, who would run the boat for him. And he would just go out there and drink and sail and be with himself and really, really enjoyed it. I think it was necessary for him. It was his mental health clinic.
And yet he had very good friends. I mean, Leslie, the man he named his daughter for.
Leslie Howard, yeah.
Howard, Leslie Howard. He had lots of good friends.
He did. He preferred the friendship of writers, as a lot of them do, the people of parts, to actors. I think he loved Spencer Tracy. They kidded around a lot between them. But they really weren't close pals. I think he really enjoyed writers because I think he liked to talk about books. He liked to talk about music. He was a serious reader. He was a serious listener to music. He loved Debussy, loved Bach. But he didn't want the world to know that. You know, he wanted that tough guy image to stay there because it sort of protected his rather sensitive soul from the rest of the world.
In 1951, he made the film The African Queen. He played Charlie Allnut, the captain of a small riverboat who has rescued a prim missionary lady played by Katharine Hepburn from German soldiers during World War I in East Africa. Now Hepburn expects him to risk his boat and his life to take revenge on the Germans. Let's listen.
You ain't no link, no, miss. That's what my poor old mother would say to you.
My poor old mother would they hear you.
Whose boat is this anyway? I asked you on board because I was sorry for you on account of you losing your brother at all.
What's it get for feeling sorry for people?
Well, I ain't sorry no more, you crazy psalm-singing, skinny old maid.
So by then he's 52 and no longer being offered those romantic leading roles. The African Queen was the next option. He hated traveling, apparently, but went on location to the Belgian Congo.
Well, he said, the monster wants me to go, I'll go. The monster being John Huston.
Okay.
But in fact, it was, the book on Bogart always said he can't do comedy. He can't sing, he can't dance, he can't do comedy. He's very funny in this movie, and it's a very touching film, particularly when he's with Katharine Hepburn, and it's old love. It's these two people who shouldn't fall in love. She's a spinster of middle age, and he's an alcoholic. She throws his Gordon's gin overboard, and the two of them have a very brave adventure together. And there's a moment when they've gone through the rapids together, and he kisses her, and he suddenly realizes that he's in love with her, and he can't stand it. He runs around to the furnace, loaded with some wood, and just you could see him staring out at the wonder and awe of love. It's a wonderful piece of acting without any dialogue. And what happened was, as I said, he didn't really like traveling at all, but he went to Africa because John Huston wanted everybody to really sweat and really go down a river and really understand what it's like to have tsetse flies around you and leeches and all the rest. And it worked. It's a wonderful film, and it holds up today. When you see it, it's a great romance. It's true that he couldn't no longer play the kind of romantic private eye that he once played, or even the soldier of fortune. But still, you believed him as a lover, and the two of them got on famously. And she said later, Catherine Herbert said later, he was the most honest actor that she had worked with. And that obviously would include Spencer Tracy. He liked to drink, he drank. You know, he liked to act, he acted. There was something about him that was very compelling to her. There wasn't any romance between the two of them because she had eyes only for Spencer. But there was a great trust that the two of them had. And often they departed from the script and just did ad-libbing together, the way Marlon Brando got famous for doing 10 years later.
It was great timing for both of them, too. I mean, she'd done another Spencer film, the one where she goes to, is it Venice?
Mm-hmm.
It just seemed she was good at that, too.
She was. This was one where she had to really get down and dirty a little bit. And I think that was very unaccustomed to her. You know, she was sick the whole way. This is one of the great moral tales that Bogart and Houston liked to drink, and they drank. And they had canned beans, and they brushed their teeth in beer. Catherine Hepburn also was the child of a doctor. Her father was a urologist that said that you must be hydrated all the time, kind of thing we hear all the time now, right? So she drank and drank and drank water, which was supposed to be bottled water, safe. Well, it wasn't. They lied to her. The natives lied to her. They sold her water that had just come right out of a faucet, and she got really sick. She lost 20 pounds, which for a skinny lady is a lot of weight, but she didn't call in sick once. She did it, but you'll see when you see that film how haggard she is, but she was just an old pro, and she went ahead and did it. But the answer is, you know, drinking sometimes is better for you than water.
You know, when I read about his young life and his, early, 20s and 30s and on, he seemed very untethered through most of that, uninterested in school or jobs. And then he decided to pursue acting on the stage by chance because somebody thought he might work there. But once the bug bit him, he was relentless, and he really worked very, very hard at it. And I wondered, in your opinion, was that a flag of giftedness, or was it desperation?
No, I think it's very interesting, because if he were a European immigrant or an Asian immigrant and had chosen different fields and finally one caught on, they'd say, yes, that's what the immigrant experience, that's what happens. But because he was a WASP from a privileged family, nobody ever accounts for that. I mean, he had the same adventures that any immigrant would have. He thrashed around doing various things that he wasn't very good at, suddenly realized, hey, show business is not so bad. I can do something good with this, and then succeeded in it. He was just like any other immigrant. It's just that he was a native of the New York soil, but he was as hard a worker as anybody who came from Europe or China at that point, South America, and just decided he was going to be better than anybody else, and he was.
I suppose a lot of people out there, young people who aren't sure what they want to do with their life, should be consoled by the story of his.
The only problem is that he really, really had a long apprenticeship. I mean, 20 plays and a lot of movies. And I don't think that kids, young actors, have that chance now. There's no Borscht Belt anymore. There's no minor league. It's very difficult. You know, if you say you're Jim Carrey, you're going to make it in your first couple of films, or you're not going to make it at all. And that's one of the real problems with show business today, is that there isn't a chance to go from AA and AAA and finally hit in the majors. And Bogart is probably the last great superstar to be able to do that.
He was taken by cancer at the age of 57, very young by any standard.
Well, he was a smoker and drinker, right. And the esophageal cancer is almost inevitable under those circumstances.
How did he manage that?
His doctor said, when a man is ill, you get to see what kind of wood he's made of. And Humphrey Bogart was made of very hard wood. Indeed. He really was a stoic about it. He refused to give in. He would never mourn for himself to the end. The last few days, he just was himself. He entertained, even drank a little bit. And the last day that Spencer Tracy and Catherine Hepburn came to visit him, and when they left, they said, good night, Bogey, and he said, goodbye, Spence. And he knew he was dying. You know, it's a very touching bit of dialogue, but the fact is he would never give in to self-pity.
You know, I just, my mind just strayed for a second. I was kind of thinking, who would play him? Who would play his life? Who
well, some people, imitators have done him from time to time. You know, when Woody Allen did Play It Again, Sam, that was a Bogart imitator. But if you're talking about somebody of that kind of masculinity, we go, when that happens, when we want a man of not no longer youthful, and we want him to appear in a role, it's usually an Englishman, like Daniel Craig or Russell Crowe. An Australian. We don't do Bogarts in America anymore.
In the 1972 film Play It Again, Sam, it was directed by Woody Allen. Allen plays a divorced man who gets dating advice from the ghost of Humphrey Bogart. In this scene, Woody Allen is trying to seduce his best friend's wife, played by Diane Keaton.
Now kiss her.
Please.
You built up to it beautifully.
I don't have the nerve.
Well, tell her how beautiful she is again.
I just told
her. Again?
You really are an unusually beautiful person.
Oh, I don't know what to say.
No, really, Ren, you are exceptionally beautiful. You're a very beautiful girl. You are very uncommonly beautiful. You're an unusually beautiful
All right,
woman.
Already.
he played a big part in Bogart's continuing popularity and
fame.
Well,
I think what happened was Bogart began to recede in popularity because in the 60s there were other things to think about, mostly modernity and what was going on screen and Easy Rider and films like that. And then suddenly he was back front and center in that film, and people began to realize they missed Bogey. They missed Bogart. They missed that presence, that the way in which he handled women, which is very cool. You know, cool became a kind of wonderful state to be in the 60s and 70s and later 80s, and he was the essence of cool. And they began to go back and see these Bogart films, and of course, we live in an age of information retrieval. You want to see a Bogart film, you can press a lever and there it is on your home screen, or you can rent it from Netflix. They're all there. And I think people have made him popular all over again.
What's your favorite Humphrey Bogart film?
Well, my favorite Humphrey Bogart film is a film that without romance. It's called The Treasure of the Sierra Madre. There are no women in it. Well, they're native women, but it's not a romantic film. And he's not a nice guy in it. He plays a paranoid. But it's such a skillfully made movie. I don't know if you remember it at all. But John Huston directed it brilliantly. And there are times when Spanish is spoken. They're in Mexico, and he shot it, as he always liked to do, on location. And when Spanish is spoken, there's no subtitles. You either have to understand that Spanish or figure out what's going on in the film. And I just think the demands made on the audience are extraordinary, and it's just one of those films that you get into very intensely, and you realize that Bogart is a real actor. I mean, he took a role which was not favorable to him. He did not look like a romantic figure. He doesn't make it to the end of the film. In fact, he's beheaded, if I haven't given away anything. But it's still one of those films you can't keep your eyes off.
His relationship with John Huston, you mentioned it several times, very important.
Yes, I think he was the one director. You know, normally people like Bogart, as with Marlon Brando and others, have a lot of problems with father figures. And, of course, the biggest father figure of all is a director on a movie set. So they're always challenging them. But I think for Huston, there was no challenge. He realized John Huston was, with one or two exceptions, probably the best director he ever had, and that he could trust him. And that was very, very important for him.
You know, there's some actors today that if they're going to be in the movie, it's going to bring home the bacon, whether it's a decent movie or not, at least for a period of time. Was that what Humphrey Bogart was like? And because I was wondering about when they cast him in Sabrina.
Well, he hated that role.
Yeah,
he hated it.
Yeah, but it did very well.
It did, but he objected to it all along. And to show you the contrast, he wanted desperately to play Captain Queeg in the Caine Mutiny, and he took a salary cut to do that. I mean, that's the kind of guy he was. Of course, he did Sabrina. He had to do Sabrina. He didn't want to. It was just a contract movie. And actually, I think he's pretty bad in it. I don't like the film at all. I think he's uncomfortable in formal clothes. He's uncomfortable playing a businessman. He knew nothing about what it's like to be an executive at a big corporation, and it showed. I mean, it's Billy Wilder, and Billy Wilder had this notion that it was really interesting to have an old man romance a young woman. He did it several times. He did it with Gary Cooper and again with Audrey Hepburn, and that was his fantasy. It didn't work out at all well, and Bogart and Billy Wilder never worked together again.
He was the greatest and ever actor. Do we need another Bogart, or is he enough for the ages?
You know, I think he probably is enough for the ages. Your point is good, because it requires a social context which is no longer with us. That is to say, the middle-aged man, the person who is willing to do certain kind of sacrifice in order to get ahead, to relinquish the woman, and so on. I think that belongs. It's a romantic figure of the past. That doesn't make it invalid. I mean, Huckleberry Finn will be with us forever, although we don't have that kind of boy going up and down the Mississippi anymore. It's just necessary to have that to nourish us at times when we feel a little impoverished in film, which I often do when I watch movies, or when we read fiction. So I think he's permanent, but he belongs to our national psyche of the past, not the present.
There's been many, many books written about him. I was wondering what inspired you to write about him now.
I had done a book on Marlon Brando a couple of years ago, and I was reading André Bazin, who was a famous French critic, and he said, the difference between those two actors is that with Marlon Brando, you never know what you were going to get. I mean, 20 different takes of the same scene, 20 different people. He said, with Bogart, you always knew what you were going to get. And that is, when you go to see a Bogart movie, you see the same Bogart. You want the same Bogart. You don't want someone different. You don't want him to be different from lighter in his step or weirder than he was. You want Humphrey Bogart, the trustworthy man from the past. You want him in film after film, and you got him in film after film. But I think that was what intrigued me. Having just done Brando, I thought I'd go to the opposite end of the world and see what that would yield, and it did.
He was the greatest. Was he your favorite actor?
He's one of my favorite. I love Spencer Tracy. I think he's one of these people who knows how to listen. You watch Spencer Tracy when somebody else is talking, you can see him intently listening to him. He had a lot of tricks. Bogart didn't have a lot of tricks. He couldn't do comedy most of the time, couldn't sing, but he had something. So he's certainly one of my favorite. I'd put him certainly in the top five, and I can certainly understand why he is number one as the quintessential American icon. That he is, indisputably, I think.
And if you had to recommend a film to somebody who's never seen a Bogart film before?
Well, I would say Casablanca, because yeah, the fakery in Casablanca, I mean, you know, there's no such thing as letters of passage, and all the rest of it is just so complete. The razzle, the dazzle, the magic, the casting is all so wonderful that you just suspend your disbelief and watch it. I think I've seen it 20 times, and everybody I know who's just flipping the dial and sees that Casablanca is on stays for the rest of it. It's just got that power.
Stefan Kampfer, thanks for joining us today.
It's my pleasure.
It's Stefan Kampfer. He's author of Tough Without a Gun, The Life and Extraordinary Afterlife of Humphrey Bogart. Today's kind of a bittersweet day. We have to say goodbye to our intern, Jeffrey Steiner. He's going off to Duke University Law School, we hope. He's been accepted, and we want to wish him all the best in the days to come. And thanks you for listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides on 89.7. This is WOSU 89.7, WOSU HD1, and WOSU 820 Columbus, and streaming online at WOSU.org, 89.7 NPR News, a service of WOSU Public Media.